We notice in the passage that we have read numerous references to places. In verse 1, to Derbe and Lystra, where Paul and Barnabas had visited on their prior journey. And then we find in verse 2 also a reference to Iconium, yet another place familiar to Paul. And then we find in verse 6 the reference to the region called Phrygia and the region of Galatia and the region called Asia, which was where Ephesus was located, and then Mysia and Bithynia, and then in verse 8, Troas, and then in verse 9, Macedonia, and then in verse 11, Samothracia and Neapolis, and then in verse 12, Philippi, and then in verse 14, in reference to Lydia, the city of Thyatira. So a number of references to geographical places that are important in the telling of this story in Acts 16. And they are reminders to us that there is always a link between history and geography. The Apostle Paul wrote to the Galatians about God sending forth his Son at the fullness of time. And when Paul wrote those words, there were clear geographical realities that signified the fullness of time. The accomplishments of the imperial administration of Caesar Augustus provided the impetus for the rapid spread of the message of Christianity in the first century world. Now, in our last message in this series, we considered the timing of the Protestant Reformation. That was the question, the Reformation when. We considered the issue of the timing of it as a product of historic forces that produced a favorable environment for the message of the Reformers. But geography was to play just as important a part in the success of the Reformation. In our first message of this series, I referred, you may remember, to a single question on the final exam in a course I took on the Renaissance during my last semester of undergraduate work. It was the question, why Italy? That was the whole exam. And the implication of that question was to ask and hopefully answer in part, why there and not somewhere else for the Renaissance to begin? Why not, for example, Egypt or Palestine or North Africa or some other place even farther from Italy? When it comes to the Protestant Reformation, we have to ask the question, why Europe? Europe is where the Reformation began. And it is where the Reformation established such deep roots that the legacy of the Reformation spread across the ocean to the New World. Why did the Reformation not begin in the Middle East? Why did it not begin in North Africa? Why did it not begin in India or Russia or China? The answer is that God prepared the European continent in a singular fashion, and the people in it, obviously, to receive the message of the Reformation and to provide it the opportunity to take root and to flourish. There were forces at work in Europe, obviously among the people, that were absent elsewhere, that took a message that appeared to be improbable and made it the dominant idea of its age. I think that is one of the most remarkable things about the Reformation. That dominance was to such a degree that we are remembering the Protestant Reformation this year, on the 500th anniversary of its beginning. You cannot say that about too many movements in history. Few movements in the world's history have cast such a long shadow. The roots of the Reformation lay in the so-called Holy Wars from the late 11th century for about 200 years afterward. The Holy Wars were wars waged by the Roman papacy, I should say called for by the Roman papacy, that had the ostensible objective of evicting the Muslims from the Holy Land. Now, they did not call them Muslims. They would have called them Mohammedans, or, as was more likely, the infidel Turk, to get those people out of the Holy Land. The Crusades, as they came to be called, were the supreme expression of the medieval order over which the Roman Church presided. But in one of history's great ironies, they also proved to be the undoing of that order. The myth at which the church connived was that everybody in Europe was the same. There was a unity, a continental unity. You hear the same things today, do you not? I mean, the history cycles back around. But that was the myth, that it was a unity and there was a cohesion there that ended up fraying into tatters. Because soldiers from different parts of Europe, under the banner of the cross, realized for the first time in their lives that there were other people who didn't speak the same language, who didn't look and think as others did. So there was that unsettling of what they had always been taught. The Crusades also opened the eyes of people from Europe to the fact that the learning of the ancient world, the classics, the manuscripts in the ancient languages, not only from secular authors, but the manuscripts in which the Spirit of God inspired the books of the Bible, those were still in existence in the East. The Crusades also changed the awareness of the reality of wealth. People who never had seen much in the way of wealth suddenly were face to face with it on a grand scale. And so the desire for change began to arise. And when the Roman Church, perhaps realizing too late what forces it had unleashed, tried to put the genie back in the bottle, as it were, well, the force was too great to contain. There was no going back. Now, we have read about the call of the Apostle Paul to Europe. And that was to be the signal. This passage that we have read is one of the most critical events in all of the history of the world. And that was to be the signal that God's purpose in the world for the spread of the gospel would find its chief manifestation in Europe and farther west ultimately. So as we continue our series of these messages, We're continuing to ask the questions that journalists learn to ask when they study journalism. Questions that we've been asking. Why? What? Who? When? And this evening we come to ask the question, the Reformation, where? Where? Now that we are meeting here tonight, and for this purpose, is a direct result of the Reformation's geography. You don't read of the Reformation making any headway in places like Palestine or Egypt or North Africa, Morocco, and so on. Geography was one of the classic subjects of study in the ancient world, and it gained new life in the Renaissance. And there are some who wish that the Crusaders would not have uncovered this subject matter. But historians, it impelled what historians would call eventually the Age of Discovery. Geography. The sense that the world had dimensions to it that people had not explored. Because the mindset of many people, most people, in the Middle Ages, was that the world was a very small place. If you had been a peasant in the Middle Ages, a serf pledged to work on your lord's land, you would have been born, grown up, lived however short a life, and many of the people did not live beyond 30 to 40 years. You would have lived that whole time within a very narrow geographic area. You would have known the village in which you lived. You would have been able to see across the fields in which you may work, to the woods beyond, and that for you would have been the world. But when the Crusades came, and people answered the call to go and throw the Muslims out of the Holy Land, these long-held perceptions of reality began to change. Some of those same peasants who had never left home saw, under the banner of the Crusades, locations of which they could never have dreamed. They traveled over vast distances. It was the adventure of their lives, and it gave some scope to think about things that they never thought were possible. And as their comprehension of the size of the world became larger, so did their readiness to hear that which defied long accepted ideas. Now you think about it. Christopher Columbus gained the permission of Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain to sail to the west in 1492, to sail from Spain to the west in 1492 with the goal of reaching the Indies, which people in the past had accessed by sailing around the Cape of Good Hope in South Africa, a very dangerous journey, and on to the islands of the Far East. But that Columbus gained the permission of those two sovereigns was a sign of the readiness to defy long accepted ideas. Now, I can assure you that there were more than a few people, probably even in the court of those sovereigns, who still believed that Columbus was a fool, and that he and those who sailed with him on those three little ships would come to the place where they would plunge over the edge of the world into oblivion. But Columbus never had any doubt that the world was round. What he didn't know, and what he discovered, although he didn't realize he had discovered it, was that there was a vast part of that round world between him and his goal, and that he would never be able to find the way past that barrier. So in thinking of the Reformation as a European phenomenon, most historians trace the major divisions of the Reformation that emerged. And it is a conventional way to think about the Reformation's geography. First was the Lutheran Reformation, affecting mainly the German areas of Europe, named obviously after Martin Luther, that bold figure whose boldness opened the way for those who would labor with him and come after him. Next was the part of the Reformation that is called the Swiss and French and Dutch Reformation, or sometimes Calvinistic Reformation. The Scottish Reformation grew out of that division. And then came the Episcopal Reformation. So the Calvinistic Reformation affected France, Switzerland, later Scotland, the Netherlands, the Low Country. The Episcopal Reformation affected primarily England and Wales and Ireland. But the Episcopal Reformation was more political in its orientation than the others were. Well, we're not going to follow that organization. That's a typical organization for considering the geography of the Reformation. This evening, I want to put to you a four-part answer to the question, the Reformation where? So that the Reformation took place in Europe was a function of four things that each begin with the letter T. Travel, technology, turmoil, and teaching. Travel, technology, turmoil, and teaching. And we're going to find some of those same elements in the passage that we read this evening. There was travel, there was technology, there was turmoil, and there was teaching. So I want us to consider these ideas in order this evening. First of all, let us notice travel. As a legacy of the Roman Empire, the European continent at the time of the Reformation still had more than 1,000 years, in some cases, after they had been built, roads that were part of one of the world's most impressive networks of travel. Some of those roads are still in use today. I don't think that there are any roads that people have built in the 20th century that you can say will last 1,000 years or more. Most of them don't last more than a few years. And then you have to have projects like the one going on the Black Canyon Freeway, where they're having to resurface the pavement when they just did that not too long ago. In the passage that we read this evening in Acts 16, we are looking at Paul and his colleagues traveling. They traveled at the beginning of this missionary journey. They traveled overland from Antioch in Syria across what is now known as Turkey, and we see some of the places that they visited. They visited Derbe and Lystra. They were using roads that the Romans had built. So they benefited from those roads. Some of the roads ran along coastlines. Some of the roads crisscrossed the interior, went to places of strategic military importance or strategic commercial importance. They also benefited, as we have seen here, from the mastery of navigation by sea that was so much a part of the Mediterranean world. Sea travel was a major means of transportation. So that when Paul and his colleagues who were traveling with them, when they were at Troas, they were on the west coast of what is now called Turkey. So therefore, they were on the edge of the Aegean Sea. And the roads that were there and the sea lanes that were there and the ability to navigate, the ability to know where the dangers were, enabled the apostle to move fairly quickly from one place to another. So you find, for example, in verse 11, this reference, "Therefore, loosing from Troas, we came with a straight course to Samothracia, and the next day to Neapolis." So one day's sail would get them from one place to the next, and then the next day would get them to another place. Now, in the time of the Reformation, the ability to travel, while lacking the high speeds to which people are now accustomed, was still the means to move relatively quickly from one place to another. And what that meant was that people who were carrying printed materials for sale and distribution could reach neighboring towns and villages in very little time. So you could have something printed in the morning in one town and have it be sold late in the day in another town. It meant that the reformers had the ability then to move about, to proclaim the message of the gospel that lay at the very heart of the movement. Now, that kind of a network did not exist anywhere in the world except in Europe, at least to the same level of sophistication. Roads that went everywhere. Now, communication became a function of the ability to travel because messages could be carried from one place to another in far less time than had been the case during the Middle Ages. And that communication was important in its revelation of the impact of one of the world's most important technological developments. And that's the second thing that I want you to consider, technology. Now, when we speak about technology in the context of the 15th and 16th centuries, 21st century people say, really? We think in terms of smartphones and tablet computers, laptops, internet, and mobile versions of communication. We just have come to take it for granted, even though there were no smartphones a little more than 10 years ago. Yes, the iPhone came out 10 years ago. There were no smartphones before that time. It's hard for people to grasp that, to remember that. In the 1980s, when this church began, there was no real ability for anybody to use the internet. I can remember when what they called web crawlers first appeared, and then you would sit there and wait for minutes while a page of text appeared on your screen. So when we think about technology in the 15th and 16th centuries, we tend to think of it from that vantage point. But I want to tell you something. None of the technologies that I've been describing compares to the impact of printing with movable type. That was an invention by the German Johann Gutenberg in the cathedral city of Mainz on the Rhine River in the German part of the empire in 1454. 1454, one of the critical dates in the history of Western civilization. Because before he perfected this method of printing, there were things printed, but you would have to make up a whole page that you would carve into metal or whatever the, or wood or whatever the medium was for putting the ink on to make an impression on a paper, and that would be it. You would make however many copies you were going to make of that, and if you wanted to make copies of the next page, you would have to do the same thing again. So to create a book was extremely tedious and expensive. So before Gutenberg's invention, books in general, and Bibles in particular, were so difficult to produce that their price placed them far beyond the reach of the ordinary man. If you were just an ordinary laborer, you couldn't afford to buy a book, and especially a Bible. And since there were no books to speak of, there was no incentive to learn to read. Why should you read? Why should you spend the time if you couldn't afford a book to read? So there was no real threat then to the widespread illiteracy and ignorance that existed. But the invention of printing with movable type changed everything. Because now you had a form and you had individual characters. And so you could put them into that form, you could lock it down, you could make your prints off that page, and then when you were done with that, you would go, you would redo everything on that form and print more copies that way. I want you to think of this. In 1400, there were fewer than 100,000 books in all of Europe. Now, most university libraries of any size are in excess of 100,000 volumes. So, in all of Europe, fewer than 100,000. So, Gutenberg invented this new technology in 1454. By 1500, just 100 years later, there were about 9 million books in the continent. So when you apply the economic law of supply and demand, when you see the supply go way up like that, what's going to happen to the price? It's going to fall. And the price of the average book fell dramatically. In fact, in just a few years, the price of books declined by nearly 90%. So stunning was the development of the new method of printing that a 40-year period from 1455, let's say, to 1495 overwhelmed the production of centuries. There were more books printed between 1460 and 1500 than had been produced throughout the whole period of the Middle Ages for 1,000 years. In a 6-year period alone, from 1518 to 1524, the publication of books in Germany increased by 700%. Now, the major impact in terms of the Reformation was on the availability of the Bible. Between 1457 and 1500, more than 100 editions of the Bible were published, and the price of a Bible dropped by 95%. Now, a common working man could buy a Bible. And if he could buy it, he wanted to read it. So he would figure out a way to have someone teach him how to read it. And he could see what it was the Bible actually said. He could see that what Luther and these others were saying was not simply a story. And when they saw what it said, the resentment against papal Rome grew even stronger. The people were awake. They devoured books. Luther used the printed word more effectively in communicating with people at large than had ever been done in the Middle Ages. And the people couldn't get enough. I mean, they wanted, you have a book, a new book coming out, they would literally snatch the copies of the books from the hands of the sellers. Luther's 95 theses, they were posted 500 years ago this year. They were theological propositions. They were written in Latin. They were meant for debate among the members of the faculty of the university. But overnight, they were translated into German and read beside every hearth in Germany. So it's possible, if you can see a people who were long held in ignorance, who now began to see the truth. And it was this technology that emerged in Europe that guaranteed that there would be a widespread interest and market for the materials that Luther and the other reformers produced. And that leads me to the third thing, turmoil. While these developments were taking place in Europe, the established political order began to fall apart. And in its place, in the place of what was called the Holy Roman Empire, began to develop strong national states with ambitious rulers at their heads who were more concerned about their own interests and the interests of the people they ruled than they were about those of the papacy or of the empire. So they were prepared to accept the arguments of people like Luther and Calvin and Knox and Zwingli, who provided reasons for the rulers of nation states to stand against the proclamations from the Roman Church. So people began to shift away from thinking of themselves as somehow part of some European monstrosity. They began to think of themselves as French or German or Swiss or Italian or Polish or any of the other nationalities, Spanish, Portuguese. They certainly didn't think of themselves as being European. And this new emerging political system and the turmoil that it was going to create became the backbone of the modern world. Now the papacy could not insist that everybody toe its line. Turmoil. And then one final thought, and that is teaching. Teaching. The byproduct of the Renaissance was the revival of learning. But in order for the revival of learning to have an impact, you had to have a way to spread it. Only in Europe was there such a system already in existence. The universities. Many of them dated to the 12th century, the 13th century. John Wycliffe studied at Oxford in the 14th century. So there was a revival of learning, and there was a network of universities in which the study of new ideas began to flourish. And if we had the time, which we do not, if we had the time to think in terms of Wycliffe and Huss, we would find out that John Huss came into contact with the ideas of the dead Wycliffe because one of Huss's associates traveled across the English Channel to Oxford and there studied some of the things that Wycliffe himself wrote. So this teaching, the spreading of these ideas through the university system in Europe provided also the fertile ground in which the Reformation could flourish. And at the heart of it all was what we find in Acts chapter 16 and verse 13. And on the Sabbath, we went out of the city by a riverside where prayer was wont to be made. And we sat down and spake unto the women which resorted thither. And a certain woman named Lydia, a seller of purple of the city of Thyatira, that was across the Aegean Sea. She was not in her hometown, but she worshipped God. And we read that she heard them. But then we read, whose heart the Lord opened, that she attended unto the things which were spoken of Paul. That was the sign of the Lord's work in her heart. She attended, she listened, she paid attention, she received those things. And when she was baptized and her household, she besought us, saying, if ye have judged me to be faithful to the Lord, come into my house and abide there. And what happened to Lydia happened in Europe on a grand scale. There were many, many people whose hearts the Lord opened, that as the reformers preached the gospel concerning the person and the work of the Lord Jesus Christ, the Spirit opened their hearts and they believed. And they believed to the extent that many of them would rather forfeit their lives than abandon what they had been convinced by the Spirit to believe concerning Christ. The Reformation had its roots in Europe. And the most powerful thing I like to point out is that because of that, we meet here this evening, because eventually those ideas in the hands of our spiritual forefathers made their way across the ocean to this continent. And we are here tonight because God worked in Europe in the 16th century. May God give us the grace in our own time then not to cast aside this glorious legacy, but to rejoice in that which the Spirit of God has done in opening our own hearts to the power of the gospel.